Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal profession. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. And we are very happy to welcome back Christina Sakunas, Director of Strategic Consulting at LexisNexis CounselLink. Chris, welcome back to The Geek in Review.
Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Seems like it was just this time last year that we had you on about the trends report. And so we got the new 2024 trends report from LexisNexis. CounselLink is just out. I believe this is the 11th year. My math is pretty bad. So is it the 11th year?
Yes, you got it. 11 years.
and Chris, you've authored all 11, right?
I have. I know it's actually hard to believe that. I think last year when we crossed the 10th year, it's kind of a shock to me to see us move into double digits. But yeah, it's been a long time, and the report has pretty much always been my baby. It's evolved a little bit over the years, which helps to keep it interesting. But yes, I have been the author.
Yeah. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about sort of the reasoning behind the report and how it's evolved.
Yeah, so many years ago, more than 11 years ago, I was part of a team that had a vision that all of the data that flows through CounselLink is an asset, right? There's an asset to all of that information related to matters and invoices that contains a lot of potential value, both for us at CounselLink and more broadly at LexisNexis, but then for the industry, you know, as a whole. So we designed a benchmarking database. We call it Insight. And within Insight, we take all of the data related to matters and billing that comes through CounselLink. We normalize that data. We totally anonymize that data and put that data into this separate database from the regular CounselLink reporting database. And since then, we've been using that database for two primary purposes. So one that you may not be aware of is that our customers, every CounselLink customer, has access to the benchmarks that come from that database. So it's a standard sort of reporting module available to them. So they're getting that data from that same database that drives then the trends report, kind of the second big thing that we always do. Based on that data to really focus on the metrics that are of greatest interest. They tend to be hourly rate related, not surprisingly. And then, but in addition to the annual trends report, we do some ad hoc analysis of that data periodically. I'd say at least a couple of times a year, I'm digging through the data to answer some ad hoc questions in addition to the trends report metrics.
Can you give us some examples of the ad hoc analysis?
Yeah. So I think it was about 3 years ago, somebody outside of our business who I was talking to about diversity, because it's around the time that diversity really kind of increased as a hot topic in our industry, asked if we could try to correlate billing rates and gender and race data together, because we clearly have billing rate data. It's all over this trends report, but we also are able to benchmark some diversity related data for the timekeepers that input that data into CounselLink, which is actually a lot because a lot of our customers require it. So, I mean, that was one sort of ad hoc analysis that was really pretty compelling and informative that there is indeed a strong correlation between billing rates and gender and race, and not in a positive sort of way. And then another example that comes to mind is one time I looked at, we called it the vendor tail sort of data. So what I mean by that is typically for our customers, they engage fewer than 10 firms for 80% of their work. 80% of their spend is coming from a small number of firms. But then the rest of their firms make up what I call kind of the tail. If you want to think about like a histogram, if you're kind of graph oriented like I am, how long is that tail, right? Because if you're engaging 1,000 firms, even if only 10 of them represent the bulk of your work, there's a lot of administration involved in managing those. So we put out some statistics around that. It was separate from the trends report.
Well, let's jump into the report itself. And I think the kind of the big thing that jumped out was the amount of hourly rate increases for 2024. And the report talks about, you know, significant increases. I think a lot of us anecdotally felt that. It's good to have some numbers, some real data behind it. So why do you think this happened? And do you mind elaborating a little bit on factors that you think increased in 24 and how that differed from previous years?
Right. Yes. So, I mean, I'm sure that when you first read the report, you were just yawning of, wow, it's not exactly earth-shattering news that hourly rates are going up. Again, right, the sky is falling, hourly rates are going up, and they're going up a lot right there. That's, and I'll elaborate a little bit more on just how much more they've gone up in the last year than they had in the past. On the surface, I think it's fairly obvious as to why firms are increasing, why they increase their rates, right? It's a lever that law firms have always used to increase their revenue. And like any other business, law firms are under pressure to increase their revenue to offset increasing costs. So there is, I think, an expectation that rates are going to increase. But the degree to which they've increased in the last year or two relative to in prior years is something to really think about a little bit more. So it's an indication that firms are relying more on that lever than other ones that they have in the past to manage their profitability. And that probably varies by law firm, right? Well, the other revenue-related lever is to increase work, to increase share of work that you're getting from corporations and other types of businesses that are out there. But that's probably a harder lever to pull, right? To get more business in the door. And then the other side of the coin is managing costs, right? And everybody, I think, does a good job of managing costs, but when it comes to cutting headcount, right? That's where conversations get uncomfortable. It is clear to me that law firms in general are using the rate lever a lot more than they have in the past. Now, why they're not using the other ones as much, I think is a question that I don't have the magical answer to, but perhaps some of your audience will.
Well, Chris, I was wondering, yeah. You know, one of the things we've been hearing over the past couple of years is just the hit from inflation. I'm just going out on a limb and guessing here, but do you think 2024 or 2023, 2024 was just a time where everyone just expected larger than normal increases? And so this was kind of not just the regular lever that we pulled, but just one that everyone expects us to pull.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I didn't mention it, right? That is part of, so costs have gone up more because of inflation rather than have to cut heads, right? It's trying to increase revenue to prevent the need to do that. Yeah, I definitely think that's coming into play as to why rates have gone up more in 2023 and in the year before that as well, which is about the time that we saw these big increases in inflation. But, you know, I think what the other side of that is that corporations are also fighting the same inflation, right? So the increase in law firm rates is increasing their costs at disproportionate amounts as well. So that it's a hard thing to manage within businesses, whether those businesses be law firms or other types of businesses. But yeah, it's a good call out.
Yeah, I want to dig in a little bit about sort of why those levers are pulled. I mean, is it, you know, does it have to do with, okay, that's what everybody else is doing, so we're going to do that too? How does the impact of specific practice areas influence the setting of hourly rates by law firms? You know, are there particular areas in general where rates are, you know, rising more sharply, or does it depend on the focus and reputation of the firm or even individual practitioners? And what might be driving these differences?
Yeah, practices are definitely a big differentiator. I mean, the fact is that there have always been certain practices that are perceived as higher value or whatever you might want to term them, but the market bears much higher rates for those practices, and they tend to be transactional ones like M&A, commercial, corporate, regulatory, right? They're the ones that jump out, but also certain types of litigation like IP litigation historically bears a much higher rate, or people are willing to pay higher rates for IP litigation and the expertise that is needed for it. To your point, Marlene, those practices, the go-to experts in those practices that I just rattled off are in the largest firms, right? So it goes hand in hand that then the largest firms charge the highest rates because they happen to have the lawyers that are in the practices that demand the highest rates, right? So those two things get tangled up together. But what I looked at this year that I don't think I've ever done this before, I know that those practices charge the highest rates. When we look at the rates, the amount to which they're increasing, by which they're increasing their rates, meaning on a percentage basis, right? So they're already charging the highest rates. And then on a percentage basis, they're able to command even higher increases. And so it's just, the rich get richer sort of analogy there. So as an example, so we see the overall average partner increase in 2023 was 5.4%. The average M&A partner increased their rates 8.4%. And they were already charging the highest rates. M&A commands the highest rates of all of the practices. So the median M&A partner rate in 2023 was $1,130, which is kind of eye-opening, a little bit eye-opening to me, because it's the first time that a median rate in any practice has crossed the $1,000 threshold, right? $1,000 is totally common now, but to have the median rate be at that level. It is interesting how these particular practices, because who's going to walk away from your go-to M&A firm, right? When you need them for a certain deal, if they're going to raise their rates, chances are you're going to accept those increases from those firms because you need them more than you do for some other practices.
Yeah. So like with this rate volatility, among practice areas, I'm wondering what the broader implications are for law firms and their clients. Are some of these more supporting type of practices for the high priced practices, are they going to go by the wayside? How are firms going to be able to kind of justify kind of their existence if they can't pull the same amount, or if they are charging much more than, say, other firms that have similar practices in the market?
Yeah.
And I'm also interested in terms of predictability in legal spending and budgeting, because again, this was a huge jump this year. Are we going to see more of that?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind related to that when we're thinking about practice areas is that in times when transactions drop, right, that does become a real problem for large law firms in particular, right, who have kind of a concentration of partners and other lawyers that are in those practices. But as long as we are in more of a transactionally rich sort of environment or economic environment, as I said, I think that corporations are going to, they need expertise to manage those types of matters, and they're willing to pay for it. I don't really see that changing at least in the short term. But, as far as predictability, one thing that is really interesting that pops out from the analysis that I do is that while individual lawyers are raising their rates at, record-setting levels, especially in these high-value practices, as I've termed them, that the blended rates that we see at the matter level are not increasing as much, or nearly as much. So even for an M&A matter, I'm not seeing over an 8% increase for partners, average increase. We're not seeing anything near that level. I think it was more like a 2% increase for matter level rates. So, I mean, that means that.
Yeah, that's some funny math. How does that work out?
Unless they're leveraging something. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it is. I know it does sound like funny math. but I mean, that's part of what makes me tick when I'm looking at these numbers. It's like, huh, that doesn't add up. I wonder why. But it means that there have to be other factors at play that are helping to mitigate those individual rate increases. So for many of our customers, who engage, you know, a lot of law firms, they often require budgets for their matters. And as part of managing to those budgets, they pay closer attention to things like staffing. For example, if a partner raises her rate 20% and, you know, now she's charging $1,400 an hour, if that partner is limited to only be involved in that matter when her very specific expertise is critical, right? That 20% increase or that $1,400 rate doesn't have much of an effect on the overall cost billed on the matter. So we tend to think of leverage as we're moving work away from partners to associates or things of that nature, but it really can be using partner A less than partner B, right? That leverage can occur within discrete groups as well. I mean, I think that corporate counsel are becoming more savvy to the levers they have available to them to help to not dictate the staffing, but to make sure that their law firms know that they're paying attention to it and asking for efficiency in who's handling that work. It's worth bringing up too, because we focus on, I mean, every article you read is about individual rate increases, including, you know, the trends report. That's our headline, right? Rates are increasing more than ever. But at the end of the day, it's the big picture that matters, and it's how you're managing all the things that go along with individual hourly rates.
All I can hear in my ear is Toby Brown saying, this is how it should work. Things should be leveraged down so that the right people are taking. So in a way, I mean, this may be a win-win. Partners get their rate increase, but at the same time, you know, work can flow to where it needs to flow. Because I think if the partner rates are too low, the clients are expecting the partner to be doing most, if not all, of the work, because that's who they know and that's who they trust.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're freeing up then those really high-end partners to go find more business or, you know, do things that are more appropriate for their level of expertise.
Totally agree.
Yep.
So do you think the adoption of emerging tech tools will influence the discussion around pricing? So I'll give you an example. Damien Real was on yesterday and we were talking, and it's like he was talking about in-house, you know, organizations, they compare pleadings to what their counsel has provided using AI. So, and if the AI is surfacing all the correct defenses or the motion responses, you know, if the work's substantially the same, then they may not pay for that. You know, they're only going to pay for what was truly value add from their counsel. So how do we get around these rate increases knowing that, you know, we have this type of capability to just do things very quickly and very thoroughly?
Yeah, that is, it's a conundrum, right? So I think that, our corporate customers are viewing that as cost savings opportunity, right? That we could be doing some of this work in-house. We can get our own value or drive around value. We don't need to engage a law firm to do this. However, I mean, I guess the caveat I would give to that is, in my experience talking to our customer base, I think that corporate counsel are looking for best practices, right? They really want to know which technology and under what circumstances that it's going to work. I think there's still a lot of hesitation. But I do think that this will begin to affect those decisions that are made about rates. On the flip side of it, right? So I'm talking about if corporate counsels start using some of that technology, but also law firms will start utilizing that technology, right? So what does that do to rates and expectations around rates for law firms? And what does that do to the law firm business model? You know, Greg and I, you and I have talked about that in greater depth in the past. I don't have a crystal ball for that, but there is no question that that is going to be applying pressure to the business models. We know it in our industry.
Yeah. Well, keep on to that crystal ball, because we'll come back to that in a minute. Well, we talked about technology. We talked about hours. We talked about the hours causing a shift from big dollar partners to maybe, you know, not as big dollar partners. But one of the things that you constantly hear in conversations is that well, big law firms are going to become so expensive that this is going to open up the opportunity for all of the in-house counsel to go flock to more of the middle market share. But your report's showing that that may not be the case, at least for, you know, the past year. So why is it that, you know, the law firms, big law firms, are able to maintain and even grow the client base a little bit, even though they're increasing their hours? Why are clients staying with them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And somewhere on my desk here, I have an article that came out sometime in the last couple of months with a headline that was saying a large law firm is starting to lose share. They better beware, sort of thing. And it's part of why I looked at that data as part of our trends report this year, because I thought, we haven't seen that in the past. Is that really happening? And you're right, we don't see it happening overall. We do see that big law, and by big law, or large law, whatever you want to call it, we mean firms that have 750 lawyers or more, and that is roughly kind of the Am Law 100 sort of size bucket. But, you know, I think we've alluded to this already. I think there are a few reasons. The obvious one is general counsels, they are tasked with managing costs, but I would argue that optimizing results and protecting their organization probably trumps managing cost to a large extent.
No one's been fired for hiring Kirkland or Latham.
Yeah, right. We've all heard it. Right? And they're having good results with Kirkland or Latham, and they've worked with them for a long time. You know, it would be a risk to change firms, regardless of the reputation of the other firm. And maybe they'll take that risk if they're really under pressure to manage costs. And then the other part of it is, you know, not just that we've had good results, but there's institutional knowledge that builds up over the years that is a really important part of that decision as to which counsel to retain to less of a degree. But another thing that comes into play is that many legal departments look to give a lot of work to one or a handful of firms across many practices because they're leveraging a volume discount, right? And so that incentivizes them to give them more work. And assuming that that volume discount really makes it worthwhile, I think it's a legitimate reason to hold on to those relationships. I do want to mention that, so in this report, if anybody reads into the details of it, in the section where we talk about that analysis of the fact that, yep, large law continues to grow their kind of share of wallet of spend. One thing I decided to do was to kind of look more to a leading indicator of that, if you will, if I can kind of geek out with that sort of terminology.
You're on the right podcast for that.
So, right, it's a lagging indicator to say, oh, last year large law grew their market share. But a more leading indicator would be, what about for the new matters that opened up last year? Which law firms were assigned those matters? So can we look at the spend associated just with new matters? And there is a glimmer of hope here, hope that this prediction that companies will start to use kind of mid-law firms, there is a slight shift from the largest firms. I'm not going to call it a trend because I don't have enough years of data to show this. And there's between practices, some practices are using large law more, some are using it less. But overall, there is a slight shift. So we're going to add a metric to our ongoing reports that will become another key metric in the trends report to show of the new matters that opened last year. What percentage of the spend associated with them is coming from large law. So there may be a shift happening with new matters. I'm just not comfortable calling it a trend at this point.
Well, speaking of shifts and trends, going to jump on to, I think, one of your favorite topics, and that's alternative fee arrangements. If I remember right, you're pro AFA.
Yeah.
So it appears, at least in a couple of practice areas, and that's labor and employment and intellectual property, there seems to be more of a use of AFAs in those areas. So what trends are you seeing in the adoption of AFAs across all the different practice areas? And what might do you think might encourage more AFA use?
Yeah, I've got my box of Kleenexes nearby in case I start to weep over this topic. Yeah, sadly, there isn't really, in 11 years, there really isn't an overall movement toward greater adoption of AFAs. So we continue to see roughly 10% of matters that have some form of an AFA attached to them. And the two practices that you mentioned, though, are ones where I think corporate counsel has become more comfortable, continues to get more comfortable in establishing primarily fixed fees due to the volume and more commoditized nature of employment work and IP work, the kind of patent prosecution work that lends itself to breaking it out by kind of stages and applying fixed fees to those. So those are, at least there's that little bit of traction that we're seeing in those areas, but it's not enough to bring up the overall average. And yeah, I was looking for more signs of hope. So I dug more deeply into the data and tried to find some specific customers of ours or corporations who have moved more toward alternative pricing. And have had success with them. And I reached out to get some feedback and input from them. And I mean, their feedback is consistent, that it requires an intentional effort led by the in-house lawyers with support from their operational teams to help to validate the pricing arrangements that they get to. But you have to have that effort led by the in-house attorneys, and then being willing to kind of pivot and try new things if you're not achieving the intended results, either the cost savings or the outcomes that you were hoping for. So I do still have hope that the industry is going to move forward in that direction, albeit slowly. I don't think there are enough evangelists speaking to not just the benefits of AFAs, but like, what is the process? What is the analytic process that you need to go through to arrive at a pricing agreement that really can be a win-win arrangement between a legal department, between the general counsel and a law firm? So maybe I need to be one of those evangelists a little bit more than I have been, but we need more.
Yeah, Jeff Carr is out racing his race car somewhere. So
we need
another one.
A few people out there. Yeah.
So, while AFAs were not one of the new significantly changed elements in the 2024 edition of the Trends Report, what are some of the new and changed elements compared to previous years? And how do you think the changes enhance the report's utility for its users?
So I mentioned, I didn't say this part about that analysis that we did related to share of wallet and which size law firms are receiving different types of work. So that analysis was part of what we called a market insight section in the trends report. So it's not one of the key metrics that we report on every year, but the idea is that we think it's important to have something fresh and new to add to the report each year, in addition to the standard key metrics to think about, well, what else should we be considering? And maybe that eventually will turn into to something that we look at on an ongoing basis. So in this particular case, as I mentioned, so we will start tracking that new metric next year related to the percentage of spend from new matters coming from large law. So I'd certainly love to hear from either of you or any of your listeners as to other things that people might be interested in us, either on an ad hoc basis or publishing more formally in this report that we want to showcase and be able to help people make decisions based on. Last year, we did the same thing where we did a market insight topic related to the number of lawyers who bill over the lifetime of a single matter. You may remember that.
Yeah.
I think there's kind of a never-ending set of questions that come up that we can dig into, and keeping the report fresh and useful for our customers is definitely front of mind.
Well, that brings us to the crystal ball question. And she's
probably got the crystal ball under all those reports on her desk.
She does. It's like I can see it. It's like right under. It's right under the frame. So you know, given the trends identified in this latest report, you know, maybe even looking back to other ones and seeing if there's any trends. You know, what sort of predictions can you make about legal industry's direction in the next 2 to 5 years?
All right. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here.
And yay! We like
AFAs. AFAs.
Yes, Gen AI.
The first place I guess I'm really not going out on a limb is that I predict the rates will go up every year, probably even more. So yeah, that's that. I think we're in that place. But I do want to go out on a limb and talk about AFAs, right? So maybe. It's not going to be next year, but, you know, I'd like to say that within 5 years that we should start to see some uptick there because there's just no way that corporations can continue to sustain these level of rate increases that they have. They have to rely on find some other pricing. And I think that AI is the other piece that you threw out there, Marlene, that as we start introducing AI more, and having it become really part of the practices of what lawyers are doing, both for in-house counsel and outside counsel, that's going to have an impact, as I said earlier, on the business model. So exactly what my crystal ball answer to that is, I think that there's going to be greater scrutiny to what that model looks like for law firms and what the effect of that should be for legal spending for corporations. And I think that related to AI and for legal departments in particular, you know, on the corporate side, I think that one of the most important things that GCs need to do is to invest in the right talent to help them understand, you know, whether new technology and which new technology is going to address their specific needs, right? Rather than following the everybody else is doing this, so we should probably buy this software too, right? To think about what their needs are and make sure that they have the right people in place to assess those needs and what tools will best fit their needs. But certainly there will be some changes coming to the technology that's in place.
Yeah. Well, let me expand on that just a little bit, if you don't mind, Chris. Because to me, I was thinking the AI itself or the technology as it advances, to tie it back to the AFAs, is AFAs tend to work on things that both in-house counsel and outside counsel deem as kind of table stakes stuff, just commodity stuff, labor and employment, IP, some IP, maybe immigration issues. But as technology advances, I'm seeing maybe more of the transactional work may turn more commodity work. Do you think that's something that's on the horizon?
I most definitely do. Right. So it's not to say that the entire transaction is commoditized, but there are individual components to it that most certainly will be. And that's the key to start to figure out, to break apart the life cycle of a matter. It's a whole project management concept, right? Of being able to determine which steps of that project really are more commoditized and can be handled by AI or lower costing resources. Yeah.
Well, Chris Sakunas from LexisNexis Counsel Inc. want to thank you once again for coming on the show and sharing with us the LexisNexis Counsel Inc. 2024 Trends Report. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And of course, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found on LinkedIn or on X at Gaybauer M, and on Threads at mgaybauer66.
And I've decided just to cut out the X and the Threads. Just reach out to me on LinkedIn. That's where you can.
Well, that is
me.
Definitely the best place you can reach me to.
So, Chris, where can listeners find out more about the report when it's out, and if they have other questions?
Yeah, I will second and third your your answer is that find me on LinkedIn, reach out to me directly. I'll be happy to get you in the right place, to the right place. Also, you can visit counselink.com. There is, and that is counselink with two L's. There's an insights tab there that you could download the report from as well, if you want to get it directly without contacting me.
And we give great thanks to Jerry David DeSica for the wonderful music you hear on the podcast each week. Thank you, Jerry.
All right. Thanks, everyone.